It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Out of Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Out of Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic.
He's like, dude, I saw you on the cover of Exclaim. I've been listening to your music. Can I buy your records? I'm like, yes, you can.
That's a good dentist.
He's actually fucking super cool. Him and the other dentist there, like, this guy, Kenneth Montague.
Okay.
You'll see his name around, like, the Basquiat exhibit. It was something that, like, he helped to bring.
Oh, Toronto. Really?
He's, like, super interested in, like, the arts community in Toronto. But this guy, Eamon Mangat, as it turns out, we're going to go back in time, and I don't know if this thing is on, but...
Yeah, it's on now.
there's this guy, Sav, who's Kenny Bridges' best friend, I think, when they were growing up. And he was Sav's medical school roommate.
Weird.
It's like totally like this deep connection.
All comes back to punk.
Totally, man. Always, right?
Always comes back to punk. I was going to say, because like there's also a Killed by Dentistry is a Killed by Death compilation that was compiled by a dentist.
No way.
And I remember Martine from Crudos one time telling me, I don't know if it was to that dentist, but he traded punk records for dental work.
No way.
Yeah, to a dentist, so...
Well, this is like the first punk rock dentist I've ever met.
I know, I was going to say, but he's in the lineage of punk rock dentists.
Totally. I mean, they never play punk rock at the dentist, but they play like amazing, like old reggae, or like just the music that they play in there is awesome, and the artwork that's all over, it's amazing. It's
I don't think it was ever like that in my dentist.
No, well, it's just like Young and Bathurst and Blue Earth. It's like,
wow. So they're like in the old Phil Glass stomping ground too.
And totally. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm dragging you away from your birthday dinner right now to do this in our mutual practice space. So
this whole
I've never done a podcast in here, and I'm like, when we were talking, I'm like, this is so perfect. This makes so much sense.
We've both spent so much time in here, probably just banging our heads against the walls.
Even though we've been here longer, I guarantee you've spent more time in here because I don't practice often.
I've never seen you here. Actually. This is the first time I've ever seen you in here.
I think I saw you here once when you guys moved in. Just like you were
loading. You might have been loading out.
We were loading out and stuff, or you were loading in.
I've seen you more everywhere else than probably the last 10 years. Like, I've seen you in more countries.
Yep.
Than I've seen you in, like, I've seen you more in different countries than I have seen you in Toronto in the last, like, 10 years.
Well, I know, and that's also because you guys are, like, touring machines.
Yeah, we've been gone a lot.
Well, let's get to the present day, but I want to start off the way I start them all off, which is, so how'd you get into punk, Chris?
How did I get into punk? I think my early days, I mean, I grew up in, I went to high school in Scarborough.
Okay.
Right? So there wasn't a whole hell of a lot of punk there, but before I moved there, I was living with my mother in Oshawa, and my sisters lived there. And I lived next door to this dude, Al Biddle.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure you know Al. And
legend.
Yeah, totally. I would say
Toronto legend.
Also, like, an incredible skateboarder.
Yep.
And I was a couple. I mean, I didn't realize until I was like 20 years old that he's only 2 years older than me. But he seemed so much older, and he was such a ripping skateboarder. So we would skateboard in his driveway. And I remember, like, you know, he was the first guy who ever played me Slayer, or, like, I remember he played me Repeater when it came out, like, Fugazi's Repeater. So that was really, like, my introduction. He played me No Means No, that's why they call me Mr. Happy. So one of my very first ever punk rock shows in Toronto, I went to see No Means No at the Palladium, I think it was called. It was, like, at Pape and Danforth.
Oh, it was, like... I never saw a show there, but I definitely remember like seeing flyers where I think it was called the Palladium.
It was called the Palladium. Yeah. I remember like I saw Eric Strip play there as well with the Doughboys and like way back.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm thinking this is probably like around 1992, but I would say that like, you know, between my sister who kind of listened to like a lot of like skate punk and pop punk from like SoCal pop punk and Al Biddle who was like a metalhead slash like full-on punk rock.
Was he playing in bands at that point now? Like, that's probably before he's in Two Line Filler.
Yeah, you know what? He was. He was in a thrash band called Boneless.
Boneless? Yeah. Wow, total thrash band.
I sort of feel like Phil Zeller played in that band, too.
Phil, too. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, but that's my, that's a Schwab. Those are my roots, right? Like, that's where I grew up, and that's where I came from, and those are, like, people that I still know to this day, who are all still doing it, really, actually.
Yeah, like, it's weird. I saw Phil. I guess Phil's back in Toronto now, but, like...
He's in Oshawa.
He's back in Oshawa. Sorry, or the greater metropolitan Toronto
area.
But last time I was hanging out with him, he was in Portland, you know? Yeah. And, like, everyone's still... Like, that's kind of... It's cool that, you know, like, your next-door neighbor, like, the first punk... Like, I can't think of... Most of the people I got into punk with, I don't see anymore. But, like, Al's legit.
Totally, man. I haven't seen him in a long time. But, yeah, I would say that between him and my sister Joanne, like, that was my real introduction. It was the... And my sister Joanne never wanted me to listen to any of her stuff because she's like, you're just going to play to all your friends and make my cool bands popular. Like that, it's a bit like of a teenage way of thinking of things, right? Like,
yeah.
This is my thing, man. Leave it alone, my stupid little brother. But between her and Al, like that was my introduction. And then when I came to Toronto to live with my dad, like basically, I grew up with my mom and my three sisters, and it was maybe a little bit too many women around me at that point in time. So I think they dumped me back into Toronto with my dad, where, I mean, there was nobody. Nobody at all. So I was kind of forced to just sort of search for things on my own.
So where you were living in Scarborough at this point? Definitely?
Yeah, like really close to like the border of Toronto. Yeah. So
Maine and Danforth type thing, or
like, no, I was like at Kingston Road.
Oh, okay,
Kingston Road and McAllen.
Yeah,
is where I spent like.
I guess it's weird because like you think in a bigger city there'd be more punk kids. You'd be apt to run into more punk rock kids than in a smaller city, but you don't. Like it's very isolating sometimes.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, well, and if we're going to continue through the history,
yeah, let's do it.
What happened from there was I had free reign to kind of do whatever I wanted, right? I moved in with my dad when I was about 11, and we moved to that house there, and I realized I was right on, there was a bus basically right out the door of my house,
mm-hmm.
and I had never been downtown Toronto, so I went with a friend, just started walking around, go down to, the big HMV and buy cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Just starting to date myself entirely. and then I would find out about shows. I think I saw, Grasshopper play at the HMV, and I was like, oh, Grasshopper's playing their show. I'm going to go to that show. I see Project 9 at that show. I was like, I'm going to go see Project 9 play this show over here. And where I meet Nick Flanagan and Andrew Mosinski. And I start going to tons of shows with those two guys. And they've got this, noisy band called Head Cleaner that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I heard a ton of music through those dudes. And then completely lost touch with them.
Did you meet Allison Baker then and stuff? Was she, because I know she was taking Nick to shows at that point, and she would have been in the Shuttlecocks and
some of
the other bands that she would have been.
I had this friend in high school named Raffy, and we did a zine together.
Oh, really?
What's
your zine called?
It was called Justy. It was named after my car.
Awesome.
So, I just got my driver's license, and my dad let me use this car all the time. So it was just a stupid name.
Yeah, yeah.
Chart Magazine had us in as the zine of the month. And then gave us a classified ad for 2 years.
That's
awesome. I had to keep on making this terrible zine over and over and over again. And through that, I met Brooke and Deb, who were doing Corpus.
Yeah.
And so I read about a ton of amazing bands. That's where I heard about the Melvins. That was where I heard about, what else did I hear about there? That's kind of where I first heard Iggy and the Stooges. And
I
stuff.
Hate God too. I remember reading
I hate
about
God.
Them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
All that kind of it was. Yeah, Corpus is a band that, I guess there's not too much of a outside of Toronto fan base, maybe?
No, Corpus was a zine.
Oh, I think you meant the band. I think you meant Corpus the guy.
No.
I was like...
But I mean, I know
I'm like, wow, that's cool. I didn't know he did a zine. That's awesome that Corpus did a zine.
Well, you remember Rat Boy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Rat Boy did stuff for Corpus the zine as well.
Okay.
They all lived together in this house on Manning.
Tony Walsh. Tony Rat Boy Walsh.
Wow, holy cow.
I don't know why that came back to me.
That's really good. That's your brain's really working.
So sometimes it does. It's the cannabis. The cannabis helps,
yeah,
you know?
That's not true for most people.
No, I know. But for me, it's webs of THC linking all these things. But yeah, totally. And Toronto had a huge zine community.
Yeah.
I did a zine that never came out. But I was just inspired because Stacey Case had his zine and was and their zine... The chart was reviewing zines back then.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We were zine of the month.
Yeah, yeah.
Month.
Well, yeah, that's amazing.
And I met tons of people through that zine community thing that was happening. And that was, that was where I found sort of, a community in the city.
Yeah.
Where I would be talking to people and find out about all these new bands. And meanwhile, I'm going to high school in Scarborough where, I don't think anybody listened to rock music. The only people that listened to rock music were me, my buddy Matt, who still plays music now, this guy Jordan, and then a small group of people.
Mm-hmm,
We were the only, the school outcasts, long hair.
The rockers.
I'd wear we had to wear uniforms to school, so I'd wear my shirt open so they could see the band t-shirt. So hopefully maybe if someone listened to music like me, I would make a new friend. But instead, I would normally try and skip out of school and smoke pot in my back deck and sleep on the couch and listen to records.
So at this point, were you was it Grasshopper and Project 9? Like that? I guess...
I went to lots of those shows.
That was the scene in Toronto, right?
There was tons of bands. Yeah, I went to see Hockey Teeth a bunch of times.
Yeah.
What was it? Politikill Incorrect.
Yeah.
But and then through that, I found out about shows at Who's Emma.
Yeah.
Which is where I first met Mike.
Yeah.
And so I used to go to, whatever shows happened under Who's Emma, I would always go to that. And I would go to, I saw, we were talking about Crudos earlier, I saw them play at...
Who's Emma?
At the 360,
actually. But then they also played Who's Emma, too,
right?
The surprise show. Or, the surprise show,
yeah.
Or the smaller
place. I don't think I was so in the know that I knew about the surprise show. But I did go to the 360, it was them and Kill the Man Who Questions.
Yeah.
And that was, I would be getting, I'd be ordering... albums out of the back of a Maximum Rock and Roll magazine or the Ebullition catalog. And so from there, it kind of grew out of that and into things like Ink and Dagger.
I love Ink and Dagger.
Yeah, totally. And you know what? That first record still stands
out. I think I've always thought if you had Minor Threat and you gave them a bunch of drugs, they probably sound like King and Dagger.
Probably, yeah.
Because it's like a little groovier. It's like, but he sounds, it reminds me of Minor Threat weirdly, like the vocals and.
Saw Don DeVore's new band, Sick Feeling.
Yeah, I hear they're awesome.
Yeah, they were
the
great.
I love the record, but
yeah,
I
it's really good.
That was like, yeah, my wife and I were out for a Valentine's Day dinner that night of that show, and
that's
my
right,
pipes
it was Valentine's Day.
My pipes burst in my house, so I had to go home. Or sorry, my babysitter's house, so I had to go.
It was a wicked show, man.
I know.
Obliterations and Sick Feeling.
Amazing.
Like, Obliterations were awesome as well.
Yeah, I love that band too. Like I've seen them live one time, but they're the
you
record.
You have to know Sam.
I know Sam, absolutely. Yeah, Sam's incredible.
He's the best.
Like, Sam's someone that I would love to have on the show eventually too.
Oh, he'd probably love to do it. That guy's got the best stories I've ever heard in my life.
And killer taste.
Oh,
like
yeah?
It's like someone who like, you know, it's like funny when you meet people that are like into like the cool, the awesome, quote-unquote hardcore bands that you have to be into, but then they're also into the cool, quote-unquote emo bands that...
He's all over the place,
all over.
Man.
And
he loves
everything he loves is, like, just awesome. Like, all the, like...
I, like, we hit it off, like, almost, like, it was, like, pretty much immediately. Like, we had a mutual friend, you know Brian Duran,
mm-hmm.
Baby Leg? Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't really know Brian, but I met Brian.
Okay, so we both know Brian, and then Sam was messaging me back and forth on Twitter or something like that. And he's like, oh, we're playing in Toronto, we're going to hang out. We had a crazy-ass night. And then we saw him in Austin again just recently where I got, like, Hayden has only ever tattooed one person before, and he gave me a tattoo that night. We had a whole bunch to drink and hung out with Sam and Jay Howell and
yep.
Travis Millard at this, like,
good crew.
Sexy boudoir like that Jay had rented. It was the highlight of my South by Southwest, that's for sure.
And you know, Jay, speaking about zines, you know, Jay
oh,
Howell,
yeah.
like now obviously zines.
And Travis. Start, Travis just sent me his new one.
Oh, yeah. But you know who Jay was living with when he was doing his zine? He was Kevin Second's tenant.
Right.
He lived in like Kevin Second's house.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know. I'm like, that's so awesome.
I can't wait to see those guys again.
Yeah, like.
Talk to them about all this stuff.
Weird, like, it all comes back to, like, everyone's got these weird punk stories, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's all, and that's the thing about when you go to South by Southwest, you run into all these people, and you're like, ah, you're here too, you're here.
Yeah.
It's like that festival kind of sucks.
Well, it just destroys you.
It
like,
destroys
physically
you.
And mentally, but. But
everyone
you see all these great people.
Yeah, all your friends are there, so you don't mind as much, you know?
Like, I'd like to go one day as, like, not a band guy, you know? And not a music business guy, none
yeah.
of that kind of stuff.
Just to see
just
bands?
Just straight up go down there. I don't even care if I see bands. It's just if I know everybody I know is down there.
Just reunion.
I just want to go see all my buddies and just
yeah.
have a good time with them.
Yeah, family reunion.
A little family reunion. Maybe sneak in a couple bands.
You know? Yeah, and also you get free barbecue and, you know,
oh, yeah.
free energy drinks that way and stuff. So.
Yeah.
So I guess, like... You know, so I guess we're talking about... Were you playing music by this point?
I had picked up guitar, and I had started playing music and kind of started throwing together a band with... it was really weird. It was... I don't even know how it happened. We were... My best friend at the time, Matt, he played bass in this band for, like, one show that kind of sounded like the Deftones or something. And I was like, all right... You and I are going to play music together. You're going to play bass, and I'm going to play guitar. And I went over to his house with an acoustic guitar. And his family had this ping pong room, a very religious family. And they didn't like me because I had long hair, and I was like a bad influence on their kid. And we wrote a bunch of songs and recorded it onto like a little cassette player.
Yeah.
And then I saved up all my money and bought myself a 4-track. And I got like really into like Sebado and Eric's Trip and a lot of home recording kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like making like these like little indie rock songs. And then we're walking up his street and we hear some kid like slamming on the drums. And we knock on the door. Like it's like sounds like such a like a classic tale, right? If this band got huge, it would be a really good,
yeah,
it would be a really good story. But it was this kid, Mike Duffield, who plays in a whole bunch of bands here in Toronto. Now he's an incredible drummer, but he was like 12 years old.
Oh,
he
really?
Knocked on his door. It's like, hey, man. And I think we were 14.
Yeah, yeah.
14 or
but
15.
That's a big difference when you're 14.
Yeah, man. It was huge. And we're like, oh, man, Mike's so young. He's going to be so annoying. But we had like tried to like find dudes to play drums, like found some really strange people. But Mike was great. He had like a good vibe about him.
Yeah.
So we started practicing in his basement. I switched over, like, I stopped, like, playing this acoustic guitar and started playing my electric guitar. But I think I learned how to play guitar by playing, I learned how to play, like, Smells Like Teen Spirit, and, the main riff for Enter Sandman.
As
and
one was, is to do.
Yeah. And
yeah.
then I was like, man, stuff is so lame. I don't want to play fancy guitar.
It's funny too when you listen to Sebado and like any of that Lou Barlow stuff. It's like how deceptively like you're like I could do this. Like,
well, that was the thing. Is like yeah. And I think that was what I found completely like charming about it all. It's like man, anybody can do this.
Yeah, and then you realize like oh no, he's also a genius songwriter too. Yeah, but
and
like
with a great voice
and a crazy voice and everything too. But yeah, no, it's inspiring too. So like, did you guys play out at all or?
We did. Like I mean,
what were you called? What was it?
The band was called Grendel.
Oh, okay.
Initially called The Clutter, then called Grendel, and I think we played until we were about 17. Our first show downtown Toronto was a Dan Burke production.
Oh.
So he was my first promoter I ever met in Toronto.
Was this the Club Shanghai?
It was a Shanghai show. And I don't want to get into it too much because I love Dan.
I love Dan too.
I think he was having hard times.
Yeah, like, and I think and I think Dan will be the first one to say that he's had some rougher times.
When we got there, I think he was in his underwear. And it was, that's yeah. all I'll say about it. But Dan was super sweet.
Yeah.
He definitely called my parents' house at like 3 a.m. a couple of times.
Yeah, definitely.
And freaked them out.
It's so hard to explain to your parents, like, no, he's a promoter. He's like, he does concerts. Like,
he was like, Chris, we really need you guys to play. We really need you guys to play a show. I was like, holy shit. Like, this is the guy I dropped our shitty homemade, like, my dad recorded a 5-song demo for us. And we went, like, I went and I dropped it off at the Rivoli, and I dropped it off, like, I walked into the places, and I'm like, I just want to drop off a cassette tape.
Yeah.
And Dan was the only guy who called me back.
That's one thing, like, Dan, and, like, you know, I love the guy, he's come through it, and he's doing awesome these days. Like, his legend in Toronto is he is the guy who believes in bands, like,
he's
first.
The most solid promoter.
The most
solid.
Like, I
mean, as far as work ethic goes, that guy's just, he's a hustler. Like, he gets out there. You see him riding his bike around putting up posters.
And you look at all
he's
the
real.
Bands, and like, yeah, and every band that kind of went on to do something mm-hmm. from Toronto, he is touched in promoting that band or their old band or, you know, like, people got going to shows by going to his shows for their first shows. Like,
yeah. Like, I mean, he's an incredibly, like, colorful character.
A very colorful character.
But he's got, his legacy is so amazing. And I actually, you know, just my dealings with him, he's always been so cool to me.
Yeah.
Like, forever. Like, even, like, good times, bad times, whatever, Dan's always awesome to me.
Yeah, like, he's someone who, like, I love when I see him now. We give each other huge hugs, and we've definitely had our ups and downs at different times, but he is someone who, you know, and last time I saw him, I'm like, you know, like, it's unbelievable. Like, if you look at, like, the Deadly Snakes, you look at, from that point on, every band he's done something with, you know, or given them huge shows.
He's also said really kind things to me in the past.
Yeah.
Like, early days of Mets, he said some really nice things to me, and I just remember it was just kind of like a, that, like, pat on the back. He was like, yeah, okay, I'm doing good stuff.
Yeah.
This is cool. Yeah, this is great.
So that was your first promoter.
He was my first promoter. Yeah, and we played, like, we charged $3.
Oh, so you actually did the whole show.
I promoted the show.
Oh, I thought you just threw you on a bill.
No. I put it together. I didn't know any bands, but I, like, just put together, like, the two bands that I knew, and we played a show in the downstairs of Club Shanghai that nobody came to. And then the next time, I think Strife canceled their show.
Okay.
And we filled in. And that was not pleasant. I remember some guy was screaming at me the whole time we were playing our wussy-ass music, and my back was to him. Because I just couldn't bear, like, I was so young and so scared. But then, you know, and then we came back.
Why would you do that to a band? Like, what?
I think he thought he was doing something
good. I know, I think he probably did too. But, like, no band would benefit from, even if you sounded just like Strife.
Yeah.
No one would be stoked in that situation.
We didn't sound anything like Strife. Our music was nothing like that.
No, but and even if it was, you wouldn't want to have that slot.
No.
So especially then.
So I mean, and then the next show that we did was actually really cool because it was basically our third show ever downtown. It was at Club Shanghai. He finally booked an all ages matinee, and it was us and Small Mouth.
Okay.
And I think what was Johnny Bunce's band? They were on. It was like a Teenage USA type thing, but
yeah,
I think it was called Skull Geek Records at the time. It was Phil Klego's.
Yeah, Phil Klego's label. But I'm trying to remember what Johnny's band was on that. Not I'm trying to think of all the Teenage USA bands.
I cannot think for the life of me what the name of that band is.
You know what? I'll put it in the intro.
Yeah, the intro. But yeah, so I think it was those two bands and us playing first. And I just remember being like, yeah, all right, cool. Now we're doing cool shows. And then Mark DiPietro and Phil started talking to us about our band. And I think I gave them like a cassette with like 30 songs on it. And I never heard from them again.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Those are also two people that believed in bands and got behind bands.
The early days
way
of, like,
before anyone else
Canadian
would.
Music scene.
Yeah, like
I mean, Phil did Pecola, which is still, like, I mean, I think those Pecola records still stand out.
Comes back to Tony Ratboy Walsh with Pecola, too.
That's right.
He did the art for it.
Zach fixes my guitars,
and Zach,
man.
And who I used to work with.
Yeah.
So, and I know Jamie I see all the time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's right.
Cattle.
He's doing cattle. And then Gideon's got a, like, Toronto Homicide Squad, I think.
Okay, yeah. So, like, everyone in that band, too. But, like, yeah, like, and Peaches? Wasn't Peaches on Teenage USA really early on or something?
Oh, man. I had a... I don't want to tell that story.
Tell the story.
I did acid one night and went to a booze can show when I was, like, 17 with that guy that I did that zine with. And I think Peaches used to go by Fancy Pants Hoodlum.
Yeah.
And she was playing this thing, and I was so messed up. I think I made a total ass of myself and just, like, walked home to Scarborough from Spadina in college. And it was, like, just, yeah.
Not a good show.
It was not. Oh, man, it was a mess.
And it's crazy that you're 17 going to a booze can.
Doing acid.
Yeah.
I bought off some guy on the street. I'd never done acid before.
I'm 35, and I wouldn't want to go to a Toronto booze can now.
It was weird. It was, like cabaret style. It was totally bizarre.
I think booze cans also at that point, because drinking was still 1 o'clock, right? Was the cutoff back then, I think?
Oh, God,
still?
I don't even know.
I'm pretty sure. So I think they were, like, a different vibe.
From what I remember, it's always been 2, but that's
I thought it was 1 then, but maybe I'm totally wrong. But, like,
well, I was, like, it was down this, it was, okay, do you know where Timeless is?
Yeah.
It was down the alleyway that used to be beside Timeless.
Okay, so right there.
Yeah, like where, like, the Lions Club was.
Yeah, because, like, the Sadies used to play the Matador all the time.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like, booze cans, you know, like, a lot more.
That was later in my life. That was when, like, we worked at HMV.
Yeah, going to the Matador.
Those things, yeah, yeah.
But that's what I mean. Like, there's, like, these, like, those places, like, you know, you like, a band is, I couldn't imagine, the booze cans that I've been to, maybe they just go to the seedier ones now, but I couldn't imagine a band playing at one.
Oh,
seems
no,
like it would
no.
get in the way of the drug use that's going on by a lot of
it
people.
Seems really European, though, you know what I mean? Like, a band playing at 4 o'clock in the morning to a bunch of, like, waste cases who are completely destroyed.
That's
and
true.
It being wild. Or it seems like something out of a Quentin Tarantino movie. Everybody turns into vampires halfway through it.
So, Teenage USA, I cut you off talking about that. But, yeah, like, so you did the 30-song demo. Did you guys release anything, or?
No. Like, nothing ever came out. We made a whole bunch of stuff, but nothing ever came out.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so that band broke up because my friend Matt moved to Winnipeg to go to school.
Okay.
He went and did that, and so him and I would still, like, trade records back and forth, but that was when I had kind of really started going to hardcore shows. That's where I met, like, Adam Gill for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, at, like, the New Year's fests and things like
that.
Yeah. I mean, I might be getting my timing way off. Like, I'm probably missing a couple of years.
No, it would have been, like, that would have, I don't know, like, I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, I'm trying to think Club Shanghai, but those New Year's fests that I would, like, when I remember, because we talked about Adam on the last podcast, because when he first showed up, he had a stack of Time Fly 7-inches, like, that were really hard to get. And so he was trading these Time Fly 7-inches. That's how everyone met him. He's like, this dude's got the Time Fly 7-inches.
It was always him and Jordan.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah,
him they were Jordan. Like, those guys were inseparable. Like,
yeah.
They would always be at all the shows.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it was, I guess they were both from northern part of Toronto and stuff, so.
Yeah, and then eventually, As We Once Were, and then No Warning.
Yeah, became out of that. So, were you working at HMV at this point? Or?
I mean, I think my first job I got was at Tower Records,
yeah.
Which is, like, the shittiest record store.
Was it the shittiest? Because I love that store.
Maybe to shop in.
Yeah, that's what I mean, to shop in.
It was shitty to work
in. Okay.
I one time threw a header card that hit Bo Bomberry square in the right between his eyes.
Did it cut?
It cut him. And it's on a video somewhere. Like, it's got to be on someone's blooper reel somewhere. that store was the most videotaped store I've ever seen. Like, they had like three security guards who were like vigilantes.
Just going after employees?
Like, no, if they would see like someone stealing, they would chase them down and tackle them in the street. It was insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it was like shoplifting was like a serious thing at CD stores and record stores, which is weird now because everyone just shoplifts music.
Yeah, it's like, there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, like it's like, you know, now it's like there's no, but at that point, man, I would, like, I wonder if those record stores are thinking about sending security guards down to your house to get you if you download the illegal MP3 at this point.
Can you imagine?
Tower, though, always had like killer zines. And books.
Well, oh, actually, that guy who did all the buying in the downstairs, yeah, all of the books and stuff, were he was really good. Like, yeah, he always like kept that thing really up to date and like always had some really interesting recommendations. Yeah. He was a strange guy, but and then Carrie Hedren did the punk scene, the punk section. And she introduced me to a whole bunch of bands. I think she used to date John Sharon at one point.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, you know, Union of Uranus, yeah, and
Chokehold.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course. Chokehold, right?
And now, of course, well, I guess, rest in peace to Brutal Knights.
Yeah, he's
in Brutal Knights, right. And now he's in Career Suicide.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot he's in Career Suicide. Yeah. That's great.
Career Suicide, now, when you think about the lines, like, Dallas Good.
it's well, awesome, I mean, lineup. Dallas was in Satanatra's.
No, that's what I mean. Right? I'm not because they're not punk. It's just like, I'm used to Career Suicide having like these rhythm sections that are, you know, like always rotating, or they have like a rhythm section that's there for a minute. But yeah, now it's like, oh wow, they've got like, it's like Career Suicide's got like the dude from the Sadies in it and yeah, the dude from Union of Uranus.
I had no idea that Dallas was playing in Career Suicide. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, he's like, I guess they're working on it. I'm giving away. Maybe not supposed to say, but
you can cut it.
We can talk. No, I'm going to leave all this shit in. We'll talk afterwards. I can tell you the whole deal. But
oh, that's so cool.
I know, it's so awesome. Like I had him interviewed him for the podcast, and we're talking about it, and he's just so stoked on it.
Oh, that's so
cool. It's so awesome to hear, like, him be excited about
it. He's an amazing guitar player.
Oh,
God. Him and his brother are insane.
They are beasts when it comes to...
And they've been doing it forever. Longer than anybody.
Yeah. And, like, that's the thing about that band, is, like, they are the band's band.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, we're talking about the Matador and them playing the Matador, like, they are used to playing to hostile crowds. Like, they would be one band that if Strife canceled, you could put them in.
And they would just do it.
They would just do it.
Hell yeah.
They would make that work. And they would, like, I could say...
They'd probably kill it.
They would kill it. Yeah. They would go over better than Strife. Kids would be like, what, Defiance, what? Like, but, like, anyway.
This country shit now.
Yeah, like, I'm over this. But, like, they're, like, the band that, like, yeah. You know, because if you play to a booze can audience that goes wrong, you can definitely play to a Strife audience that's
gone. Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. So you're working at Tower and...
Yeah, I was working at Tower and, I was, like, working at the Ticketmaster booth at Tower, which was, like, a hostile place to work because people got pissed off when they couldn't get their tickets to the shows. So I'd have, like, these lineups at the door, like, people who were furious. So I had to get out of there, so I got a job at HMV and ended up working at the info desk at HMV because I had years of experience working this independent record store in Scarborough.
Oh, really? So you'd already worked at a record store?
It was called Deja Vu Discs. It was, like,
I've heard that place.
It was this little CD shop. And it would be, you know, you kind of had to know the whole store. So I had, like, a fairly general knowledge of everything that was in there.
Yeah.
Like, I knew what was coming out. I knew it was doing this. And I guess it was a bit of a different time for me because I was around all that stuff all the time. So I would know whatever, like, the top hits on the radio were, but I was constantly listening to other music.
Yeah.
You know, it's where I started hearing, like, all, like, the DeSoto record stuff and, like a lot of the Touch and Go records. Like, I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, I heard the Jesus Lizard because some dude sold it to me, like, probably to buy more crack or something like that.
Well, I was going to say, like, a UCD store, too, it's like, you never know what's going to walk through those doors from having been someone who's always searched in those places.
It was where I heard, like, Jawbox and Jawbreaker and probably, like, Drive Like Jehu for the first time, you know. All these things would come in because, you know, people would trade it in so they could get, I don't know, whatever the new hit record was
that
they wanted. The stupid kid didn't. Their kids didn't want their records anymore. Weren't living at home. Sell them to me.
I think I actually got my Metallica "Ride the Lightning" and Deja Vu disc. Now that I think about it, it was on Kingston Road.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, then I definitely knew. Yeah,
Kingston and McCown.
Right, yeah, where I lived. Yeah. That, okay, then I definitely went there and bought.
I worked there when I was 18.
Okay.
So and then I moved down. Like I was living downtown eventually, and going back there to work, and then I was like, this sucks, I'm going to get a job as, like, minimum wage.
And those were, like, the dream jobs. Yeah. Record stores, like, because, you know, I would come in every year and apply. Yeah. You'd always help me out, too. You'd always be like, yeah, I'm going to try and help you out, but I must have been unemployable.
Did you never get, you never worked there?
I never got an interview.
Jeez, okay.
I know. No, but I know, no, believe me, I look back on my resume and it must have been pretty bad.
I'm pretty sure the Tower Records one was a form resume.
I never applied to Tower. Tower, I think, was already gone, by the time I was applying.
Yeah, I worked there, and then I upgraded to HMV.
Yeah.
I came on as seasonal help for Christmas, and they were going to put me in rock and roll, but they give you, like, this little music test.
Yeah.
Like, they used to give you this music test, and I think I totally aced the thing, because I had all this deja vu disc experience.
What was the test?
Oh, I don't know. It was like, who sings this song?
Oh, it's like actual questions.
And name this person. Like, if this person's last name is this, what's their first name? And it's like this, like, 20 questions type thing. And then I had, like, an interview with two people who kind of grilled me on a bunch of stuff. And they decided not to put me in rock and roll. They decided to put me at info, where you had to have a general knowledge of the whole story,
yeah.
Which was really cool, right? So, and then you just start talking music with everybody. So my interests in music kind of went in all sorts of different directions. And I was going to a lot of punk rock shows. And funny enough, my friend Matt met the guys in Monin when they were traveling through, heading out to the West Coast on, I think, maybe their first Canadian tour. And he's like, this band's great, blah, blah, blah. And when they're coming back...
So you hadn't seen them in Toronto at this point, or...?
I had seen them, and okay. I told him to go see them.
Oh, okay, okay.
I was like, they sound just like the Get Up Kids, man. You're going to love this.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, they're touring out west, and he saw them in Winnipeg the first time. And when they're coming back, I think they mentioned something about how, like, their bass player was going to quit, and he had given them the final Grendel recordings. And they came back and they're like, "Hey, our bass player is leaving. You want to play bass?" And that is the first time I ever played bass in a band.
Wow!
And I did that for like a year and a half, and then left that.
So that was your first band when you were in.
That was, like, my first touring band.
You were only in Monin for a year and a half?
Yeah, year, maybe 2 years.
Wow,
yeah.
I think I must have seen you guys a ton, because, like, when I think of Monin, like, you're the bass player I think of.
It was for that first record. It was, like, maybe, some grindy, like, pretty rough tours.
Yeah. But you guys, like, opened for some bands, too, in Toronto, like, bigger bands, I remember.
I think we opened for
someone at the Opera.
Buried Alive or something like
that. And the Phoenix?
Oh, we opened for H2O.
H2O the Phoenix, that's right. Yeah, I totally remember that show, too.
The weird show.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did that for a little bit, and then came back and just I played in a band called the Abandoned Hearts Club after that.
You were, I totally fucking forgot you were in Abandoned Hearts Club too.
I had made, like, pretty good friends with, like, Ben Popjoy and Sean Butchart. So
were you a fan of Spread the Disease and stuff too?
Yeah. I mean, like, hardcore black metal band from Oakville.
Way ahead of the curve.
Because you see,
how ahead of the curve that band was compared to what's popular now.
Totally. But, I mean, that's the thing, is I missed, like, a whole chunk, because there was a whole part of my youth where I was traveling from Scarborough to Oakville to, like, go to, like, these church shows.
Yeah.
Because the hardcore bands wouldn't come and play in Toronto.
Yeah. Toronto was kind of,
I'd go see punk rock and hardcore bands play, and, like, I saw Ink and Dagger play in the basement of the church in...
Streetsville? Was Streetsville
church? I don't know if it was Streetsville or if it was Oakville. It's one of them.
It's funny, because, like, yeah, like, and I people get mad, like, older people from Toronto, when I'm like... There wasn't a hardcore scene in Toronto. Like, there was a hardcore scene, mm-hmm. and it was like... But when Hockey Teeth broke up, it was like... there were a lot of older people that were in a hardcore, but they're for, like, kids, like, around you, me, are the same age, pretty much, I think, within a couple of years. And so, like, there wasn't that much in Toronto. You had to go to the suburbs to see all these bands, like...
You had to go to the west suburbs. There's nothing happening in the east
nothing
suburbs.
Nothing happened in the east suburbs. No. Well, there were, but...
Justin Small might tell you a little bit different.
And also, I was going to say, like, Stiffs... Who became Dead Letter Department?
Right. I saw Rob last week, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. They were the first band.
Toronto legend, Rob Moyer.
Exactly, and one of the first bands gave me my start singing in a yelling voice on stage.
They headlined a high school show in Scarborough that my band played.
Really? See, it all stiffs.
It was them and Maryland's Vitamins.
Maryland's Vitamins played that high
school
show.
They're all East End bands. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Maryland's Vitamins from Orangeville.
Oh, damn.
And, but then Rob joined, and he's from Scarborough. Right. That was, man, that would have been amazing. For me, that would have been a dream high school show because I was a huge
It was like Mowat High School or something like that. So it was like Pharmacy and Lawrence.
Oh,
so
that's
it was
like awesome.
Way out there.
Yeah, well, you're right. There weren't there East End. There wasn't a ton of
stuff.
Didn't
happen. No. So like to get anything to like catch any of that stuff, I really had to like make an effort to make it out to the west end of the city.
Yeah,
but I knew enough people who had cars and would, you know, that's how I kind of started hearing like about a lot of hardcore stuff. I would like, you know, and I would order records because, I don't know, for some reason, those, like, Ebullition, like, mail order things, you could get, like, 10 records for, like, $35.
They were so
like,
cheap. The price code, like, A,
yeah,
this much.
Just, like, write it in on a piece of paper and put it in an envelope and send it away.
And also, they always had the back page of Heart Attack, which was, like, 25 cents.
Yep.
So, what a brilliant marketer Kent McClard was from Ebullition.
Right.
Like, he makes this zine that everyone reads, and the back page is always just a catalog.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I've got to get this. I got to get this. I just finished reading about this band.
Yeah. So through all that stuff, I met like, and through going to shows in Oakville, I met like, you know, people who I'm still friends with today, like Ben and Sean and Tyler Semrick Palmateer, who ended up doing Mare, who I played in for a little while.
Wow. You played in like so many different bands that like.
I was just kind of like a fill in guy. So like
Was it just like you didn't want to stick in these bands? Like, why'd you like?
I think with the Monin thing, it was the personalities.
Yeah.
Like, we weren't getting along.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was basically, I got kicked out of that band basically because I was like probably really difficult to get along with.
And then Abandoned Hearts Club, you guys kind of
broke up. Abandoned
Hearts
Club was just, it was the most abusive, like the most like mentally abusive band I've ever been in.
Everyone was hard partying too by that point.
It was pretty bad. I wasn't ever much of a hard party myself, but it was a lot of like just destructive insults to each other, and you have to like thicken your skin, or you're just gonna get destroyed.
Yeah.
So eventually, I was like, I can't do this anymore, man.
Did they break up? Like shortly
thereafter? Yeah, I left. Like we signed to like Metal Blade or not Metal Blade?
No, it was like Century
Media.
Yeah,
it was
like a
division of
Century
Media called Abacus. And I was like, I can't do this. I'm out. So
did that Abacus record come out or no? Or
no, it ended up just getting like kind of that. There's this dude from Montreal that like kind of picked up on a bunch of this stuff and just sort of put him out on the internet.
Okay.
So we did like a 7-inch with Init Records out of Providence, and then this full length or 7-song record, which I actually ended up not playing on. I wrote all the songs with him, and then I bailed.
Yeah.
And I think at that point I was like, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. It's like 25 years old. It's like my brain hurts and like my ego is shattered and I'm so fucking broke. I just want to make a little bit of money and like live comfortably for a little while. And so I did that for a little while. I guess I was maybe 24.
Yeah, I think that was like right around when you and me went to the Warped Tour together. Remember we went and stayed in a hotel. We were like, you were there for work. You were there for work, and I was helping Alexis on Fire sell merch.
That's right. Yeah.
And you immediately hung on that, like the hotel bar. I'm trying to remember. Like, I have this vague recollection of us being in a hotel bar.
I have almost no recollection of this.
Do you bet? Like, do you remember?
I remember. I do remember that we did. Like, we shared a room at the Warped Tour because I was working and I had a hotel room.
Yeah, and I was up there because Alexis had been like, "Oh, just come hang out with us." And I got on a ride with Trisha, and she's like, "Okay, well, can you help us sell merch?" And I'm like, "Sure." And then you're like, "You can stay in my room." And I'm like, oh, thank
you. I probably had an extra bed.
You had an extra bed.
Yeah.
So let me stay in your room.
I wasn't doing anything. I had to like go to work at the crack of dawn.
Yeah, we both had to get up and go to the Warped Tour,
which is a nightmare, man.
And the Toronto Warped Tour is like the biggest one, I guess, right? Or was?
It was pretty big. I remember just going out to those fields, and it was amazing watching them set that thing up. It's like, just it's like traveling roadshow.
Dust Bowl
pops up. Yeah, totally.
Total Dust Bowl.
So yeah, I guess I must have been like 24, and I was like, yeah, I'm out. I remember at my crazy apartment in the annex, I sold my bass rig to some guy from Mississauga.
Oh, you really? You sold all your gear even?
I sold it on Ontario Music. I've never sold a guitar. I've never sold like a bass or a guitar or anything. Like I always really like to keep that. So I wasn't done playing. I was just kind of done like doing like this grindy like playing music I didn't really want to play, I guess.
Was that to force you almost to not do another band, you think? Like, you're like, I'll get rid of my rig. I'm not going to take any more gigs.
I was just fucking miserable doing it. Like, truthfully, like, I found, like, the towards the end of that band, I felt like I complained about it more than I enjoyed it, and I was probably, like, really hard to be around because I was so miserable. So I think I took a few years to sort of, like, balance my life out a little bit. I was in so much debt from, like, I mean, from Unin, I'll say, like, from touring with that band, I just, like, dug myself this huge hole.
Yeah.
Because I was so broke and starving. Like, I weighed, like 90 pounds. It was, like, this thin, just, like, dying.
And that was, like, also, I don't know, it's that feels like just before the time when bands kind of, you know.
No, it was right when, like, right before Alexis on Fire and all those guys
blew up. Really big, right? Yeah, and, like, it was just, like, it was still, what, like, what you were doing, if you were touring, like, you guys, how many shows did you play in that year and a half? Like,
oh, God, I don't know. Hundreds? A lot. It was a lot. Like, we would do these, like, these tours in the States where you would play a show and you'd be stuck in, like, Arizona for 7 days.
Yeah.
You know, with no shows.
Did you guys only do North America?
Yeah, I only did North America with that band. And then, so, yeah, so later on in my life, like, I you know, made friends in the city and lived, like, a fairly normal life. And I always played music and, like,
You were in the music biz. Like, you were, like,
I ended up, yeah, getting jobs, like, working at, like, as a promoter.
Yeah, like, and I don't mean that as a shitty, like, you were in the music biz, like, but I mean, like, you were always, like, I'd go visit you at work, you know, and, like, we'd hang out. And, like, it was always, like, Chris is, like, you know, it was never, like, you checked out of music.
No, I, like, what I did was, like, I went and I started working at House of Blues, and then I just started putting on shows on my own with Eric Warner just because I was like, this sucks. This job is such a bummer. Like, I'm working with these bands I don't like. Maybe I'll try and do some stuff that I'll actually enjoy. So I was putting on shows with Eric Warner for, like, 6 years or something like that. And somewhere in the process there, Hayden moved to Toronto, and Alex moved to Toronto. And I hadn't met Alex before, but I had met Hayden because he was dating Julia Deacon.
Okay.
And
who worked at HMV, right?
She worked at HMV.
You think about people that worked at HMV, it's like, what's his name from St. Clair?
Ian
from St. Clair. Yeah. Sandy from Fucked Up.
Sandy, yeah.
Oh, God, I'm trying to remember some of the other people. That guy that who ordered all the metal CDs and then took all the metal CDs and opened another store?
Yeah, that was amazing.
Did you work with that guy?
I did. I remember that guy vividly.
I remember going into a store.
Metal Tim,
who did Brave New World.
Brave Words, Bloody Knuckles.
Brave Words, Bloody Knuckles, that's it. Yeah, but, like, the guy, I remember going to a store just north of the Danforth one time and going through and just finding all these crazy CDs, and they were so cheap. I'm like, and this is, like, when you couldn't get CDs cheap. And there was, like, a newspaper article about how the guy was from HMV and all these CDs had gone missing.
Oh, man.
And all this sort of stuff.
Did he ever get, like, arrested for that or anything?
I think he got sued. Oh, the store got shut down.
It does make sense.
In the end.
But, that place was, like, I mean, that guy Evan Davies worked there. And I think he ended up becoming a writer
or
something.
Yeah,
Daryl Weeks, who's now, like, a big publicist guy. He worked there when I was there. So lots of people, like, who ended up, you know, working in music or playing in bands or just doing, like, you know, all sorts of stuff. It was a pretty interesting place to work.
Yeah.
And
it was also at a point where, like, it was the place to work. You know, like, if you knew you weren't going to get hired at Rotate.
Mm-hmm.
You knew there was, like, Full Blast only had 3 people working there, so there was no job at Full Blast. So it's like HMV on Young Street. That's, like, the coolest job
you get. You could get some good stuff there.
Yeah, amazing stuff there.
I worked special orders, so I special ordered all sorts of great stuff.
Mike bought the HoFX 12-inch there, the NoFX HoFX 12-inch.
Really?
Back in the day. Yeah.
Wow, holy cow.
So, yeah, you could get some. I got my Sonic Youth membership to the Sonic Death Fan Club from HMV on Young Street. In Dundas, so
wow,
we're plugging the store. We're giving. I want to.
It's gone. It's like it. Like, don't even bother.
There's still a little sliver of it, right?
Yeah, but it's not the same. Worth going in there.
It's not the same.
I mean, if you're gonna go and shop at HMV, the store, you may as well just buy all your records on Amazon.
Yeah, it's not the same vibe as it once. You're not gonna run into members of Sinclair now.
No,
and I don't think they sell. Do they still have Brave Words, Bloody Knuckles?
Don't know. But, I mean, Martin Popoff is writing books. He's, like, one of the main contributors.
Yeah, yeah.
I met tons of, like, really interesting people working there.
So you met Hayden. I guess you knew Hayden through Julia.
Yeah, so I had been working at House of Blues doing, like, I was, like, one of the big promoter's assistants. And I was helping do production here and there. Yeah. And trying to, like, you know, get out and learn some sort of skill to do something else. And, Hayden moved to Toronto And Alex moved to Toronto, and the version of Mets that they had already had fell apart because Chuck stayed back in Ottawa to keep his job with the government, I think. And
did they release? What did they have released by that point? Did they?
There was a CD of like four songs, I think. That I don't think you can even find anywhere anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So they moved here, and they didn't know what they're going to do with their band. And I was Hayden. So it's a funny story. Hayden invited me over to his house. An email. I get this email. I'm sitting in my apartment. She goes up, "Hey, I'm having a barbecue tonight. You should come over." I was like, "Okay, I'll go over." Like, you know, there's a bunch of people. There's a barbecue. So I go over by myself. Show up with, like, you know, a six-pack. And I'm like, "Hey, man, how's it going?" He's like, "Yeah, come on in." And Hayden's really quiet. And you kind of got to break the ice with him a little bit at first. And I didn't know how it was going to go. But I walk in, I was like, "Hey, where is everybody?" He's like, "Oh, no, no, I'm just barbecuing some food. I invited you over to, like, barbecue some food." He's like, "All right." I was thinking in my mind, I was like, "He's going to kill me." not really.
No. Were you a Three Penny Opera fan, too? Like, did you know him from playing?
Yeah,
yeah,
I saw them play. Yeah. And, you know, he had messaged me a whole bunch of times, like, trying to get me to book The Grey in Toronto, but I just never had anything for them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to drag a band to Toronto to play for $40 to nobody. So, yeah, we were just, like, sitting in his backyard, eating some really disgusting veggie burger, and drinking beers, and just, like, you know, as we have, like, a few more drinks, we're, like, warming up and, like, really, like, you know, having a really great conversation. We walked down to the liquor store to get, like, more drinks, so we drank everything we had. And as we're walking back, I was like, "So what are you guys doing with the band?" It's like, "I don't know. Like, we're just, like, we're looking for a bass player." I was like, I play bass, but I don't have any gear. Like, I have a guitar, but I don't have any gear." He's like, "I have gear." He's like, you should come and play. You know, no big deal. If it works out, whatever. And so later on that week, I grabbed my guitar, hopped in the van with him and Alex, grabbed like a six-pack and went out to Islington Rehearsal Factory, where we practiced for like 6 months. I was like, "Man, this is so much fun. It's so easy to be in a band when you're an adult."
Yeah.
You know, when everybody's not all like wound up and sensitive, you know. So I think I needed those few years to, like, kind of level out my life and understand, like, how to be around people for long periods of time without losing my mind.
Did you miss touring? Because, like, it sounds like you're, like...
I didn't like touring.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I, like, really didn't like
you
it.
You do so much of it now.
I love it now.
And is it just, do you think the time away from it that made you love it? Or do you think it's just, like, you do it differently now?
I think it's just being an adult and, like, or, like, you know, or at least knowing, not feeling that sort of, like, weird self-consciousness that I always had. Like, I was feeling like you're truly a part of the, like, you're, you know, our band is the three of us, you know, it's very, very much the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so being around those guys, like, I mean, they're my best friends. I love being around those guys. And
yeah.
Going on tour with those guys, it's kind of like, it's like hanging out with your brothers or something like that. You can have arguments here and there, but at the end of it, like, we all love each other and we all get along really, really well. So, touring with Mets is a total pleasure. We get a chance to, like, go and see all sorts of, like, amazing stuff and, like...
Do you guys do that on tour? Do you guys actually go out as a group and sightsee, or do you guys split off at all?
I think it depends on where we are. Sometimes we do that. I think everybody takes their time alone.
Yeah.
Because I think if you don't take some time and, like, take a walk around the block by yourself and sort out your thoughts, you'll go crazy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, Pat from Women said that. He's like, "Take a lot of walks." Like, "You just take a lot of walks and you'll be okay." I was like, "Yeah, I know." So yeah, we're like, touring this band is really the only time I think I've ever really truly enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I enjoy it more and more as time goes by, you know.
So where I guess you guys were playing for 6 months. At what point did you? What was your first show with Mets?
We opened for Quest for Fire at the Boat for their first record release.
Wow, so that's...
Almost against our will. Like, we didn't want to play the show because we didn't think we were ready for it.
So how long were you guys hoping to practice?
I don't know. I didn't think we were ever going to play a show, to be honest. In my mind, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to be ready to get up on the stage again.
Was it just, like, lack of confidence from taking time off, or do you think it was, like...
I guess so. I mean, we had all these songs, and, like, I thought they were good, but I don't think I ever... I didn't ever really see it as, like, anything I would ever bring out of the practice space at first. And then Hayden was really good with friends with Chad Ross from Quest for Fire, and Chad's like, "Why don't you guys come play the show? Come play. You can play first, you know, it'll be your first show, it'll be a lot of fun." It's like, okay. So we played like their sold out show.
Yeah.
Our first show ever with those guys, and so we were really grateful that they let us play that show. But after that, we're like, wow, that went really well. Let's do another one. So we played another show, and it was like, you know, not as many people there. Actually, I think our second show was with women.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Ian Russell from Flemish Eye had asked me to book a show for women and Mount Royal. And I was like, okay, I mean, I can't guarantee anything. Their record's not out or anything like that, so...
Where'd you do that show, The Boat, too?
It was The Boat as well. So we played that show and ended up becoming friends with those guys and women. And then our third show was with this Toronto band called Ten Kens that doesn't exist anymore.
You stumped me there. I was going to be like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's Dean from Adonis Adonis.
Oh, okay. I love Adonis Adonis.
Yeah, so. It was his old band, and that was where I met Dean.
Okay.
You know, so that's our first three shows. And then from there, it was just kind of like this, it was like a ball just kept on kind of rolling. And we just, you know, we would play one, maybe two shows every month, and then eventually built it up where we played, the Coliseum asked us to play in Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto with them. Ended up, you know, getting along with those guys really well. I mean, Hayden had known a lot of these people from back in the day, like driving bands or like just being a straight up rad dude.
Yeah, because he was so young when he started playing in bands.
18,
right?
I think, when he was doing Three Penny Opera.
Yeah, and that, like, when I was,
when he played with Fugazi, I think he was like 18.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, you know, obviously 18's not young to be playing your first band, but when it's like a real band, yeah, it's young to be playing.
It was a pretty real band.
Yeah, like for. God, I saw that band. So they were one of my favorite bands. Like, yeah. I just love that band so much. Seeing them at Club Shanghai, I remember they played the hardcore matinee or the hardcore hotline benefit show at Club Shanghai.
He's talked about that before, I think.
Well, I'm glad to see he's probably really happy now that he lives in Toronto and gets to see where all that money went. Where you can call the hardcore hotline whenever he wants.
We still meet people quite a lot that are like, you're in Three Penny Opera. That's amazing.
It's funny, like, because they. Now this is like the fifth or sixth time they've come up on the show. Yeah. They come on the show a lot.
You gotta get him in here, dude.
I know. I was telling him the other day. Like, one day we'll talk about it on here. You know, because it'd be fun to really, like, grill you on that thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like, people always hit me up about it. Like, Three Penny Opera. Like
that's awesome.
Yeah, you heard you guys mention Three Penny Opera on the show. That's awesome, and stuff. So you guys are playing shows at this point. When did you ever try? When was your first time to the U.S.?
Well, that was the problem. Hayden had been denied entry to the U.S.
Yeah.
And he had been banned for 5 years. It took him 8 years to get back in.
Because you have to get a pardon once you're...
Yeah, well...
Or, like, not a pardon, but, like, an official thing.
The other guys, like, they waited their 5 years and they could get back in. But Hayden had, like, some sort of, like... And it still haunts us to this day, but, like, he had special circumstances. And, I mean, he's, like... pretty, like, clean, straight-up dude. No. Like, there's no real reason for it. But they basically got busted trying to cross the border without a visa.
Which many a band has.
I mean...
Us.
Well, I mean, did you guys not, like, did you guys not call yourselves fake names specifically so they can look you guys up?
We were hoping for it. And the only time we got busted was when the Globe Mail printed our real names. The first time we ever got written up in a big newspaper, the Globe Mail used our real names.
Because I remember, I was like, that's genius. These guys are so smart.
We were like, but that's the thing about these borders. Like, the border, you know, I still get nervous crossing it. With the visa, it's still, like, the most nerve-wracking experience because it comes down to...
It just depends who you're talking to.
Exactly. Like, there's no, like, it's not like a computer where it's
the Wild West.
It's like, it's, if you have someone, and I know... From myself, if I have a bad day, God help anyone I come in contact with. But luckily, I'm not in the position to refuse anyone entry from a country.
Sure, yeah.
But I love them, so I'm not going to talk any bad about it.
So Hayden couldn't get in, so we were just, like, doing whatever we could with what we could.
You guys toured Canada, right? Like,
we went out east with Young Widows once. I booked, like, an East Coast tour. Which, I mean, God bless those guys. They actually went on East Coast Canadian tour. It's great. I love going out there, but
you have to be
Those guys played New Glasgow to like four people, and I'm pretty sure Evan wanted to strangle me. And then we got asked to play like our first West Coast Canadian tour with These Arms Are Snakes. So we drove to Vancouver to do that.
Oh, and deadheaded out there.
No, we stopped in Regina and Calgary to play shows in those cities on our way, which we played on the way back as well. And it ended up going really well. Came back, And eventually we're just like, man, we got to do something. So Hayden and I were just hustling, trying to figure out how to get him across the border. And his time, the window of time that he needed to stay out of the States had expired. So I just applied for a visa for us. And he started talking to this lawyer. And then Death From Above asked us to play the Metro in Chicago with him. And I was like, man, we have to do this. So yeah, we got approved for our visa. And he got this crazy stack of paper from this lawyer, and he paid some obscene amount of money to try and get his pardon and have it like wiped from his record. And we go. Actually, what we did is we drove to Niagara Falls, and Alex and I went and sat in like this bar waiting for Hayden as he walked over to the border to talk to the border guard to see if he could get his work visa. Border guard's like, yeah, this all looks pretty good. Like, had like a little powwow with him, stamps his thing, gives him his like little paper and his passport, and Hayden walks back. And he psychs us all out, like, looking all depressed. He's like, oh, we're all good. So a month later, we go to Chicago, the Lollapalooza weekend, and play our first ever U.S. show at the Metro with Death From Above. And then from there, it was sort of, I would book, like, a trip. We got to go play New York City, so yeah, we went and did, like, the cake shop. And did like the cake shop and somewhere in Brooklyn.
Oh,
like, no, we did Death by Audio. Or,
oh, Death by Audio.
Death by Audio was the first place that ever took us in. And it went really well, so we started doing a little bit more. And at that point, we had almost finished writing our first record. So we started recording that thing. We finished it and sent it off to Sub Pop, who liked it.
Had you been in touch with them prior, or did you know them at all?
I knew. I had an email for one guy from working with the Constantines back in the day. And I just sent it to him.
And they were like, the Constantines, was that the last Canadian band into you guys?
No, like the Wolf Parade was.
Oh, Wolf Parade. But was that after that was after Constantines?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Never really looked into that. Chad Van Galen.
Oh, yeah. Of course, Chad Van Galen.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was Canadian bands doing stuff with that label. And, I mean, there was Memory House from Waterloo or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
But that...
They put out a record. They put maybe two records on Sub Pop.
Was that later?
It was later, yeah.
After the
it
first
was before us.
Oh, it was before the first semester? Oh, okay. Well, then fuck my point then. Thanks, Chris.
Sorry, man. I'm just
trying to... You could have let me get it wrong and just let me know.
I'm not going to let you get it wrong. It's going to come back on me. So anyways, yeah, we sent that off. Sub Pop liked it. I didn't hear from them for 3 weeks, and then I finally get this note back from the guy, Chris, that I sent it to. And it's like, hey, Chris, I'm so sorry about not writing you back. And it's like this three-paragraph email, like the first two are just like all apologies. It's like... All right, well, you know, we gave it a shot. We'll probably just self-release this thing. And I read the last paragraph. Said, we'd really like to put out this record. We'd like to find a way to make it work. And we hadn't sent this thing or played it to anybody, you know, like nothing.
Was there a backup plan? Because, like...
Backup plan was we're just going to put it out ourselves.
Put it out yourselves. Because, yeah, like, you know, like... Sub Pop is the coolest. Like, that's one of the
coolest. We were pretty excited about it. Yeah. And it was, like, it was really... It was where we felt like it would fit.
Yeah.
If it was going to fit anywhere. So we sent it off, and we were like, wow, this is really, really cool. So, yeah, we ended up sort of, like, winning the lottery on that sucker. And so I was working freelance that summer doing production down at Echo Beach. And
before the rebranding of Echo Beach.
That's right. I helped, like, the first year it kind of really opened as a full venue to, like, try and keep it, like, do, like, make sure it ran smooth.
Yeah.
So I was doing that and saving money because I knew that when this record came out, I was going to probably have to tour. So, like, and I was excited about it because the band was fun to play and fun to tour, and our Toronto shows were starting to get really, really good, and, like, you know, we were getting good reviews and things. Or we were, you know, 3-7 inches in. And,
yeah, like that, like with the vinyl stuff, was when were those getting out to people? Were you getting hearing back from other labels? Because, like, I love those singles.
No labels were interested in us, actually. We did like the two with the three with We Are Busy Bodies.
Yeah.
Which is essentially kind of like releasing it ourselves.
Yeah.
But, we did those. We weren't really getting any sort of label interest or whatever. Nothing, if we did get anything, it was probably nothing that we really entertained.
Yeah. So what was, like, the goal prior? Like, did you, was this ever, like, this? You know,
no,
like, you're about to
leave for
like, a huge tour.
No, I saved up 3 months worth of rent for my place. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go on tour. I'm going to put out this record. I'm going to go on tour for a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, take time off work when you need to take time off work. And then live your life and play in a band because it's fucking fun. And so we went on the tour, and as we were going, more dates were coming in. We got offered to play Primavera. We got offered, like, these festivals in Europe, and we're just like, wow, this is insane. Record drops, and it comes up as, like, best new music on Pitchfork, and we're all just like, what is happening right now? This is totally insane. Like, because I think when our band first started, we were like, no one's going to like this. It's like, this is just, like, us goofing around a practice space making a bunch of noise.
Yeah.
Writing these songs that are, you know, caked in feedback.
Well, especially if you're, like, waiting 6 months before you even play live the first time.
Yeah. Well, it was fun, you know. It was like you'd go in and goof around for 3 hours in a room and make a bunch of noise. And, yeah, so we just went on tour and just kind of never came back. Since then, it's just been, like, this kind of, like, this ongoing thing where now if we want to write music, we have to take a bit of time away, try and write. So this new record ended up being, like, we did this West Coast tour, and we're like, we got to take a couple months off and just make sure that we focus on making this record, because we had, like, a handful of stuff, but we have a really hard time writing on the road. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the hell you guys get so many songs.
We don't write on the road. I've never, oh my God. I think the road sucks. I can't believe bands write on the road. Like,
we wrote one riff on the road.
I think, like, they might, yeah, like, I shouldn't say we, because maybe Mike and Jonah and the rest of the band are doing stuff, but, like, I just think it zaps creativity when you're on, because you're just like, it's almost like that's when it becomes the job. When you're like,
sure, yeah, yeah. You're zoning
day.
Out?
Well, you're not zoning out, like, because you're playing the show and you're having fun playing the show, but, like.
Oh, that's not what I meant, like, when you're zoning out in the van. Like, when you're.
Oh, zone out, yeah, that's what I mean, zone out in the van. Yeah.
For us, we have, like, so much focus on playing our show live. It's, like, so much fun to, like, play, like, yeah. A live show, and, like, it's that whole ecstatic process of, like, actually doing a live show.
And it's the whole rest of the day spent recovering and getting ready for the next one.
Well, anticipation leading up to it, and then relief afterwards, and then anticipation and then relief. It's like this total, like, up and down game that you play with yourself. So you try and, like, take your mind off it by watching a movie or reading a book or something like that.
Not writing a song.
Yeah, I don't think, like, I mean, I think about it almost all the time, but it's not something that I'm normally just like, all right, today I'm going to sit in the van with a guitar and hopefully write some music. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not terribly inspiring being, like, in a little panel van, you know, with a guitar in your lap.
Yeah, no.
So anyways, yeah, we came home and we locked ourselves in this obviously incredibly inspiring little room and wrote this new record. Alex would come to practice after, like, sitting in his house, like, drinking coffee and writing riffs and be like, I got this cool riff. It's like, all right, we'll work on that riff. And some stuff made it and some stuff didn't. But the process ended up being, like, really positive. And we made the record. And it's something that we ended up being really, really happy with.
Well, I could go on for another hour and talk about just
that stuff. But my wife is going to slaughter
you. I was going to say, your wife would kill you. Yeah. So why don't we call it, come back on another time?
Absolutely, we'll
do another one, man. But
that was a deep, deep Chris Lorak history right there.
Well, that's what
anyone's going to want to hear that.
That's what people always say. But I think, like, you know what? I wanted to hear it, you know? And so hopefully there's other people that want to hear it. Because I think, like, you know, like we talked about, like, it's amazing how you see this interconnectedness between every band, and there's all these people that just, like, connected through knowing people, and I just like seeing how people get to where they are.
You know who's really responsible? Just to go back, if you want to punch this in, you know who is really responsible for a lot of, like, the hardcore that I got to know, and the hardcore I got to see is Ewan Exall.
I know it. Like, I would say Ewan too for me.
Ewan used to borrow my band's PA. Like, I owned a PA. He would borrow it to put on shows at Who's Emma.
Yeah.
So I would get guest list at his
shows. Yeah. So you go and see all the shows. That's
it was awesome. Like, it was.
Yeah, like Ewan for me too, when he was working at Rotate, and I'd go into Rotate and he'd be like, oh, check out this. And he'd be like, oh, Ignite? He's like, yeah, check them out, they're amazing. I'm like, oh, they're incredible. Like, you know, like, no, like Ewan is something, like, you know, there's so many people. That's also why I love doing this podcast. Live with Biddle. Yeah, Live with Biddle. Another connection, you know, but I like how. I should also have you on for the Matt White episode then.
Are you doing one with Matt White?
I want to do a Matt White episode eventually.
I hung out with Matt White for a bit.
I think everyone. I
played guitar with Two Line Filler for.
Were in Two Line Filler?
I was not in Two Line Filler. Okay. I played guitar with Matt at his house a bunch of times.
Okay.
For what was going to be a revival of Two Line
Filler. One of the revivals.
And it didn't happen.
Well, that's for part two.
That's part two.
That's part two. Thanks, Chris.
It would be a very interesting conversation.
It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening. And you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front. And everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there. Because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.